Sometimes you need to knock some people out.
Ah! What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
This is the Health and Wealth Radio Network.
Ugly. And now, because it's the law, here is your legal disclaimer.
All matters discussed on the Health and Wealth Show are for informational purposes only. Each individual situation may vary, and the opinions expressed here may not apply to everyone. Materials presented by that dead sexy David Ernest are believed to be from reliable sources, and no representations can be made as to their accuracy. All ideas and information should be discussed in detail with one of our highly qualified representatives prior to implementation. And that is your legal disclaimer.
This is your roving reporter, and today I'm talking with the man who performed the very first pig-to-human heart transplant.
Hello!
You took the heart out of a pig and put it into a man.
Yes, and the patient is doing fine.
I must say you are very good at what you do.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll tell you someone else who is very good at what he does.
Who might that be?
That's that preservationist David Ernest, man. He is very, very good.
I've heard he's the man to call.
Yes, if you want to make sure retirement is there when you want it, call David Ernest today at 334-279-7431 or 205-479-0839.
I guess he has his fingers on the pulse of everyone's finances.
Yes.
And you say the patient is doing well.
He's doing quite well. Would you care to speak with him?
I'd love to talk with him.
Let me call him for you.
Sweet! Sweet, 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 sweet!
I'm just going to stand over here so the lightning doesn't hit me.
Oh, what lightning?
Uh-oh.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Matthew. Today is going to be part of the Health and Wealth Show on the health side. You know, we talk a lot about the wealth and the politics of the wealth. We'll talk a little bit about the politics of the health and also about clinical laboratories. And some of you may not know, not only am I a financial advisor kind of guy, but a long time ago, I got a degree in clinical laboratory science. So really, I'm a clinical laboratory scientist and a financial person. I've done finances a lot more than clinical laboratory science. But once you learn these things, of course, I went back to school and worked on a business degree and stuff like that, MBA, worked on that. And then, of course, I've got about 40 years or better, a little better, in working with finances, financial stuff. So I'm kind of a weird bird, I guess you could say, that I'm a scientist and a financial advisor, which is kind of weird. I get it. So I don't know. Analytically, I look at numbers like I would if it were in a laboratory. I break it down to the basic substructures of what we're doing. Anyway, today I'll talk a little bit about money too, but today I want to talk about what is a clinical laboratory. You know, a lot of you folks talk about, you know, blood being taken. Some people are afraid of blood. But all blood is a transport medium of, you know, mostly oxygen. Now, it does a few other things, too. But mostly it's just transporting and delivering the oxygen molecule to your cells. And if this didn't happen, it wouldn't take but just a matter of minutes for your brain to die, for your body to die. Your brain would be first because it needs more oxygen and more nutrients faster than any organ. course, the other organs are important too. One of the organs that you don't really need, I mean, it's nice when it's working, is the organ that picks up the red cells whenever they're damaged, and that's your spleen. You know, a lot of folks wonder what really happens to red cells in the body, that they're delivering the oxygen, and those are delivered and picked up. The average length of, they say the average length of a red cell corpuscle living in a human and before it's replaced is something like 120 days. Of course, it could be more or less, but your body is constantly making these things in the bone marrow. That's the other thing. Where is all this stuff made? The bone marrow. The bone marrow is where all the living cells, other than the cells that are part of your anatomy, like your pancreas and other cells, are made. In other words, all blood cells are made in the bone marrow. That's where they originate, the young ones. Now, a lot of folks don't know that leukemia, and there's all kinds of leukemia, is nothing but a bone marrow disease, or a blood disease, if you want to call it that. But the bone marrow becomes sick. And really all it does is makes too much of crazy young cells, which packs out in your system and literally kills you from lack of working properly, and also too much blood or too much of, you know, white cells or whatever it's making. It literally just takes over your body, just like any other cancer would, a mass, if you want to call it that. But anyway, I know this is morbid stuff, but I wanted to talk more about the blood system. Clinical laboratories work a lot with the blood system. They also work a lot with what we call biology or microbiology. Now, let's break this down. You've got clinical chemistry, which is when you're running tests on the blood. You have clinical microbiology, is when you're trying to find out what kind of germ. We, in the laboratory, they call them bugs for slang, but essentially they're bacteria. And now, instead of growing them on petri dishes, and like, you know, when I first went to school, that's practically all we had, was something where you could grow it on a petri dish where it had a nutrient in it, which usually was blood involved in that, or something that, but now a lot of the microbiology is being done with DNA or something similar to DNA or some kind of gas that they detect. Everything is becoming very, very, very sophisticated. And also, artificial intelligence is kicking in gradually, but mostly most laboratories are run with button pushing. Of course, when you're dealing with button pushing, you got to understand what kind of button to push, what the results are, garbage in, garbage out. It's just like any other kind of computer thing. But then you've got all these instruments that are analyzing the things that they're trying to find out. Say, like, a normal blood chemistry, what would that consist of? Well, forever and ever, it's been this. It's been like, okay, sodium, potassium, chloride, CO2, that's your electrolytes, okay? Then that tells you kind of how the body is in balance. If the body's out of balance, then essentially you're going to have a sickness. Then you have some other kind of test. For example, something called blood urea nitrogen, BUN for short, would show dehydration or possibly some beginnings of kidney disease. BUN is normally associated closely to something called a creatinine. Creatinine is measured because it shows how your kidneys are excreting creatinine, and therefore it gives you a value of how well your kidneys are working. So a high creatinine means your kidneys are not working very well because it's not being excreted. Now, creatinine is nothing but a breakdown of the energy that your body's using, like creatine and some other things. You know, there's this thing called the Krebs cycle that we have to study when we go to school and everything. That stuff's very complex. And most of the stuff, after you learn a lot of it, you analyze in your own mind why you're doing these things. But essentially, it's just to give a report on a person that's in a lab, in a laboratory setting or in a hospital. Now, there's several kinds of laboratories. The clinical laboratory is usually a hospital that is connected or in a hospital. Right there at the fingertips of the doctors that need these results. So therefore, when you go to a hospital and you see it says laboratory this way, or they say we got to draw blood and send it to the laboratory, what they're talking about is the clinical laboratory, which has several departments, not just blood, but you have the urine, urinalysis, you have the bacteria, as I've talked about a little earlier, which, you know, is like clinical microbiology, if you want to be technical about it. You have the hematology, which is actually blood most of the time, but it can be other things. Now, hematology is when you're counting red cells or white cells, but you're also looking at the morphology. In other words, what they look like, are they normal looking? And also, are they in the normal range of numbers that they should be in? For example, a white cell count of 4,000 to maybe 10,000, depending on the laboratory, would be normal. But if you had an elevated white blood count, it means you're either got a bad virus or a bad bacterial infection. And normally, the type of cells that would show up would indicate what type of infection. And here, for example, neutrophils, which are segmented neutrophils or whatever you want to call them, those, they got several names. If they're normal looking and they're mature and you've just got a little bit of a high count, you know, maybe 12,000 to 20,000, it probably means you just got a really bad bacterial infection. This tells the doctors this instantly, without them having to really do a whole lot. And they give you antibiotics or whatever. And then, of course, they will send something to the microbiology lab to try to find out what kind of infection it is, if they know something's going wrong or going on, that they can collect that specimen and send it to the laboratory so they can back up what is causing the high white count. Now, speaking of white counts, let's say that someone had a very high lymphocytic count, which could be associated with maybe mononucleosis. Mononucleosis is known as the Kissing disease, which is actually caused by a virus called the Epstein-Barr virus. The Epstein-Barr virus is in practically every human alive. It is a natural host to a human. Maybe as many as 1% or less might not have it, but it's very unusual. You get this disease very young, and, you know, mononucleosis or something associated with it. Some people, though, get chronic mononucleosis, or should I say chronic Epstein-Barr virus diseases. And those are other things that can happen and cause maybe even a cancer or something later on to occur. But essentially, the laboratory is a tool that gives the physician an initial result of what is going on in their blood. And hematology is very, very important. So most of the time when you first come into a hospital, the two things they're going to order on you, unless there's other things wrong with you, would be a chemistry, meaning all of those things, sodium, potassium, chloride, CO2, BUN, creatinine, and various enzymes, which I'll get into a little bit later. What do those look like? bilirubin. That's something that they would look at to see if you had something going on in your liver. So all these things would shoot off. There's panels of tests, of, you know, short panels, long panels, depending on what they won't run on you. Back in the good old days, they ran everything, and they probably still do run most everything. There are some instruments that nurses and doctors are using at bedside. One of those used to be called an iStat. I think the iStat is still available, but it will give them, in an emergency situation, some chemistries and glucose. Now, that's the other thing that a lot of folks know. You know, they say my sugar's high, my sugar's low, whatever it may be. But essentially, if your sugar is high, you might be a diabetic, or you might be under a lot of stress, something stressing your body, or you might have eaten a lot of sweets, too many in your body couldn't handle it. And of course, as time goes along, your body gets, especially if you have the genetic predisposition to become a type 2 diabetic, then you will gradually become insulin resistant. In other words, your cells don't like insulin. They don't like taking in insulin. Insulin takes the glucose into the cell to burn as an energy. Okay. And if your blood sugar gets too high, then your body can't, if the insulin's not working properly, or if it's, you got insulin resistance or whatever, then what's going to happen a lot of times is you're going to become ketonic. In other words, your ketones are going to go up because you're burning fats. And when you're burning fats, that means that you have an inability to burn the sugar because you don't have insulin or your insulin resistance or something. And you can read all about that. But blood sugar is measured by clinical instruments that are very accurate. And those will tell a physician whether you're having some kind of blood sugar problem. And that can be related back to your pancreas. There are cells in the pancreas called the islet of Langerhans, which they have not been able to really treat as well as they wanted to. Yes, there have been islet of Langerhans transplants, the way I understand, into the liver and pancreas, but into the pancreas, but it's not very common yet. But what is more common is trying to control your blood sugar, your ketones, and all these different things that are going on in your body with insulin or something that like metformin and some of these other type of new drugs that are coming on. You know, some of these drugs that are coming on now can actually cause people to lose weight. Why? Because they're messing with the system that's going on in your body that's attuned to glucose. And the relationship between insulin taking the glucose into the cell, and for some reason, and you can read about all this if you want to Google it, all of that is related to a lot of times the way fats are being used and a lot of other things that are being used. Because when your body stores fat, that's what makes you gain weight a lot of times. Well, all the times. But it is very complex. And you know, I want to speak very elementary here, and sometimes I'll get a little bit too overboard on this. But so getting back to the clinical laboratory, you have the clinical chemistry laboratory. There's going to be in the same laboratory, maybe right next door, or maybe just a few feet away from a hematology part, maybe just a few feet away from where they run what they call urinalysis. Now, why would you want to run urinalysis? Look at it under the microscope. Do a dipstick, as they call it. Well, the dipstick, they stick it down in the urine, and then they look at it. Now they have machines that will look at it, and they just dipstick it and throw it in a machine. The machine will spit out. It'll say the ketones are high, or it might say there's bacteria in this urine. Or it might say the pH is a certain number. You know, the pH of the urine is usually between, oh, like 4.5 to 6.5 or 7. The bigger the higher the pH, the more alkali it is. So that tells you something, especially if you see crystals. If you see crystals in the urine, it can tell the doctor if there is something going on that's a little bit of whack, like, you know, maybe they're building up too much crystallization and they're possibly prone to having, you know, some type of attack with stones that build up inside the urinary system and the kidneys. And, you know, maybe they could change the diet or something, you know, certain kind of things. But, and there are other crystals that might tell you something's going on, like a cholesterol crystal, which is very rare, because that means that there's a lot of things going on, or bilirubin crystals. Most of the time, you look at something called an amorphous crystal, which is like, you know, calcium oxalate or phosphates. Those are things that are typically normal inside a urinalysis, but you can report those. Some things that are abnormal are parasites. You can actually see parasites in the urine sometimes. There's all kinds, like Giardia or something like that. You can look this stuff up. There's so many different kind of parasites, amoebas and things like that, that can happen in the human body. Most of those parasites, though, are not spilled over into the urinary system, but would be in the bowel system or the disposal of waste. And that goes back to parasitology, which usually is associated and connected to the microbiology department. The microbiology department is got a lot of different things in it. Most of these folks are what we call experts or professionals in that department. A generalist that works in a clinical hematology, blood bank, and in microbiology, a generalist is someone who works at night, works in the evenings, usually in the daytime. That's when most of the laboratory scientists are in the lab, and each one of those usually are specialists. So they may work in bacteriology, otherwise known as microbiology, and that's all they do. But they still have the background of all the other departments, but they just get used to doing that department, which means they become very good at it. And also in blood bank, during the day shifts, usually the blood bankers just do blood bank. Blood bank is a very highly specialized department. The evening and night shift techs, clinical labs techs, would work, or scientists, if whatever you want to call them, they would just check blood in an emergency or blood that needed to be, you know, the day shift people didn't do, or the evening shift people didn't do, and then the night shift does it. Essentially, you have to do type and cross match in the blood bank. Why? Why would you have to do a type and cross match? Because if you give the wrong blood, then it could kill somebody. Why? Because the blood system has on these red cells and on the white cells too, but we're not so concerned about the white cells. On these red cells, there's this thing called antigens. These are usually sugars that are on the red cells that build up an antigen, which the body builds an antibody against. As some of you folks might have heard of allergies, which is a different kind of antibody. But if once a person becomes allergic to something, then they would have a reaction if you put that substance in their body. Well, blood has natural antibodies and antigens that occur naturally on all human beings. And one of the biggest systems is something called the ABO system. That was the one that was tested in the early 20s and 30s on all blood. But the Rh system was not really used a lot until maybe the 40s, I'd have to go back and research the times. But anyway, now whenever they do someone, they might say, oh, he's A positive. Oh, he's A negative. The A or the B or the O would be said first. And then whether you're Rh or negative, Rh positive would be said second. So if you said someone was B positive, that means that in the ABO system, they're B. And in the Rh system, they have it. They're not negative for Rh. Those are the two most important systems on a red cell in a human body that can kill you if you get the wrong blood. And there are many others. Kale, for example, is pretty common, but building an antibody against it is not as common as it would be to have an anti-Rh antibody. Now, people usually develop anti-Rh antibodies whenever they've been transfused or had a child. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I'm talking about, clinical laboratory, and it's very complex. And if any of you guys want to become a clinical laboratory scientist, any of you college folks or any of you grandparents that hear me talking about this kind of a profession, I'd be glad to refer you to some people that I know that can help them decide what they want to do. It's an honorable profession because you're really a scientist and you know a lot about the human body and blood and tissues and bacteria and everything else. I mean, you're working, you have the background that you understand what's going on, and you're highly educated. The pay is fair. I mean, it's you can make more money somewhere else, but as far as satisfaction and need, you probably never would not have a job. And you don't usually have to have direct patient contact unless you're drawing blood or blood gases or some other thing in a smaller laboratory. But anyway, I know we got to take a break here, Matthew. I want to tie this in soon, but with what I do now with my life and how science merged into finances is something that I could explain in my life. But anyway, let's take a break and talk a little bit about Earnest Financial. And again, this is a health show, not so much of a wealth show.
Have you come up with any ideas for a new commercial for Earnest Financial?
Well, I tell you, Double R, I have been racking my brain to no avail.
I was in the reading room thinking and couldn't come up with anything either.
The reading room?
You know, the reading room.
Oh, that reading room, yeah.
But I do have one idea. It is simple and to the point.
Okay, man, lay it on me.
We just tell everyone to call David Earnest at 334-279-7431 or 205-479-0839.
Uh-huh.
Then we tell them how good he is at handling money.
You mean the old money man with the money plan story, huh?
Exactly. We do that and we're done.
I love it, man. Just call David Earnest at 334-279-7431 or 205-479-0839.
Exactly.
See, I just got an idea myself.
All right, what is it?
Me and you and the Swedish bikini team.
Tell me more. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, man. I thought you might be.
This is your roving reporter, and today I'm speaking with an adventurer here in the Himalayas who is searching for the abominable snowman.
Hey, man. What's happening?
How is your search going?
Not too bad, man. It's kind of windy out here today, so I'm taking a short break to call my money man, David Earnest.
The world-famous asset preservationist.
Yeah, man. That's him. He is my money man, you know?
Well, what number are you calling?
He has two, man. 334-279-7431 or 205-479-0839.
And after you talk with him to make sure that everything is fine with your retirement money, you will continue your search.
That's right, man. As a matter of fact, before you came up, I thought I spotted the abominable snowman over there.
Over there?
Yeah, right over there. He was standing next to a snowbank, putting snow up his nose.
Let me see those binoculars. Oh, sorry.
That's not him?
Nope, that's Hunter Biden.
Hush up, boy.
Thank you very much. Yes, and yes, we are talking about the science and the procedures of a clinical laboratory, mostly hooked to a hospital. Now, there are other kinds of laboratories that are not clinical laboratories so much because they're diagnostic laboratories, because the clinical laboratories will send the blood to these diagnostic laboratories because they run tests that are more rare. Not every clinical laboratory can run every test. Matter of fact, I don't think there is a clinical laboratory that runs every test. Therefore, they have to be backed up with research, or should I say, laboratories that do more rare work. An example would be if you needed to send something to what is called an outside laboratory. And there's several outside laboratories in Alabama. But one of the most popular outside laboratories that most every lab sends to if there's something that the doctor requests could possibly be Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic is one of the most respected outside laboratories, diagnostic laboratories on the planet. And let me say this, Mayo Clinic Hospital in Rochester and Mayo Clinic's clinics scattered across the United States are great. It is the number one hospital for diagnostic work and things in the United States. Of course, your Cleveland clinics and your Johns Hopkins and, you know, all those other kind of clinics are up there in the top five, top 10 also. So in Alabama, we do have a hospital that's rated pretty high and it's a pretty good hospital, and that's the University of Alabama in Birmingham. It's, of course, then it's connected. I don't know if it has an administrative affiliation, but it is connected to the Children's Hospital of in Birmingham. Now, let me talk about Children's Clinical Lab in microbiology and hematology. Those are little bitty fellers. I mean, some of these kids are so little, you know, they would get the blood from their capillaries, sticking their heels is what they do. Not their fingers, but their heels. And they draw the blood in these long, little long cylinders that look like pipettes. And they take those things and spin them down. And that's how they get their blood. They're not in tubes. Now, they can draw their blood in small tubes. But, yeah, I worked in a clinical children's hospital in Birmingham for 1 year when I got out of school. And essentially, I learned a lot, but I also learned a lot about small specimen size. Small specimen size is something that all laboratories would love to learn how to do for little kids. So these big hospitals are not really good at working with little kids because they're not used to using small specimens. And there was one revolutionary person who said that they had small specimens, and it turned out they didn't. And they, a $9 billion organization turned into nothing. And that lady right now is in the penitentiary for disgracing the clinical laboratories across the United States and pharmaceuticals that were working with her. And you can look her up. I'm not going to mention her name, but it's a disgrace that that happened. But so small specimen size, small specimen size is something that's very difficult to be. So the specialized hospitals like children's hospitals are good at it, but not so much the large hospitals. So if you've got a little feller that's sick, really, really bad sick, maybe they can do okay in a big hospital in, you know, any state like Alabama. But if they get really, really sick, probably going to be better to take them to the children's hospital so that they can be taken care of, specially when they're little. Get the small specimen sizes. You know, I talk to people in the medical field a lot. Actually, I dealt with them a lot to begin with. And like anesthesiologists, anesthetists, people like that, that put babies to sleep, put children to sleep. A lot of them, if they only work on adults, they're scared. Not, that's a bad word. They're not really used to putting little ones to sleep. So that those are specialists too, also in the anesthesia department. So the little ones, you really want someone who's used to working on children. It's like neonatologist. And that is something that doesn't have a lot to do with most clinical laboratories. Most clinical laboratories are geared for adults. They're pretty much able to be able to put process through machines and equipment that it would be difficult to run through children's blood. But it's getting better because the specimen sizes are getting smaller and smaller. And therefore, even big labs are getting where they can work with children better than they ever have been able to. So getting back to the departments of a clinical laboratory. Again, we have the clinical chemistry that I mentioned earlier, the clinical microbiology, the clinical hematology, but and I talked a little bit about the blood banking and how important it is to cross-match blood to make sure that when you get this blood, it won't cause a reaction and possibly kill you or at least damage you pretty bad. And it's so important that whoever's given this blood watches you for reactions, because sometimes there's other kinds of reactions that can happen with blood. And it's just so important that the nurse and the doctor and all them do keep an eye on you when you're having a blood transfusion. Now, in an emergency, you've heard of this thing called the universal donor. Well, essentially, the universal donor is not really a universal donor. They're a 99.999% universal donor. And what is that? It's O negative. O negative can be given to any ABO. It can be given to any RH because it has no RH substance and it doesn't have B or A substance. It only has O. And all blood usually is built upon the O system with these different sugars that build up and cause you to have a B or an A or both of them being an AB. So the probably the two most common bloods are A positive and O positive, not B positive, not negative, or not B negative. I don't know why it has to do with genetics. I guess you could go back and study it, but essentially there's not as much of that. And there's definitely not as much as AB negative. AB negative is probably a very, very rare type of blood. AB positive might be next to that. But essentially, there's one that's even more rare. That if you have it, you probably could not be transfused without damaging your body tremendously, even with O negative. And that is something that we studied in school, but I never saw one. You probably never would see one. There's estimated to only be 100 of them in the world, and they're called Bombays. Why do they call them Bombays? Because they found them in the city of Bombay, India, and they have no O substance. They only have something called H. They have anti-H because they don't have any H substance making the O. So essentially, they have anti-everything on the blood cell in the ABO system. And you can't give them any blood unless it's their own or some other Bombay, which would be rare as hen's teeth. So hopefully you never run into anybody or know anybody that's a Bombay. But they do exist. They can't get blood from anybody unless they're a Bombay, or if we could ever create artificial blood that would work, which they're working on. Now, there's another department or two that I never trained in. We learned a lot about them as histopathology and cytopathology. Those are totally different. They work closer under the pathologist because they're helping the pathologist study the morphology of a cell. And usually, yes, they're looking for something abnormal like cancer. You know, in the clinical laboratory, We detect cancer in the blood because you'll have something called blast and various other young cells that come out of the bone marrow. But those blast means they're small, young cells, the prelude of turning into an adult cell in the blood system, which is white cells and red cells. But in the anatomical system, in other words, organs and skin and things like that, cytopathology is looking for abnormal cells there. For example, when a woman goes and gets a pap smear, that is a cytotech looking at that cell. They're looking at cells they're scanning these things. They're looking at these things real fast on the microscope. And if they see something abnormal, they grade them according to a grade system, and they'll pass it along to the pathologist to review. And then if you have an abnormal cell, then they will call you back in maybe to take a biopsy or whatever they do. Now, the other thing is histopathology. This is studying the cells a little bit more than just taking a sample, but maybe cutting slices of a mass or something like that, where they can look at this thing a little closer to see what type of cancer it is, or is it a cancer, or is it something else? Okay, so I can't talk a lot about those two because I don't have a degree in cytopathology or histopathology, but I can talk to you a lot about a clinical laboratory because I had to work in those things and study those things, and I got a degree in that, okay? And so I can talk a lot about that. Now, molecular biology is something else that's fairly new. Again, molecular biology does have a lot to do with DNA and testing for DNA. They can do testing to see, paternal tests and test that you may have the likelihood of potentially having a cancer genetically. When I was in school years ago, they said they thought viruses could inject into the DNA. Now they know they can. Now they know that we can inject into the DNA. Actually, now they are talking about repairing the DNA. And they've actually got things going on now in these really highly advanced laboratories and hospitals where they can actually splice out a bad DNA chromosome or chromosomes and replace it with a normal one. Now, some of you might have heard about a child having three parents. And you think, now this is kind of crazy because they have three parents and this was put on a petri dish. But typically, they got three parents, but they really only got two main parents and one that only gives the maternal DNA called the mitochondrial DNA. Okay, why would you have three parents? Why would you have someone strip away the mitochondrial DNA, which is normally with a female DNA, and put it and replace it with another female's mitochondrial DNA? Mitochondrial DNA diseases, that's why. Those can cause havoc to a child if you know that you have these diseases. So if you know you have one, then you can strip it away and replace it with new mitochondria, fresher, or should I say better, more healthy mitochondria DNA, splice it in, put it in. That's just an example of what they can do. Now they're finding certain kinds of chromosomes that cause all kinds of diseases, genetic diseases. They can splice those out and put them in there, replace it with a normal one. They can actually do this now, the way I understand, with someone who's already living, not just in a petri dish before they're born, when you're trying to get the zygote put together in the embryo. Essentially, they can actually do this when you're already here, breathing and living entity. They can replace some of these genes through genetic manipulation. And this is something that's really, really needed, especially with these childhood diseases and things that are coming on pretty strong in medicine, where in the world where medicine can help cure it. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do. Now, I've talked a lot about clinical laboratories, I mean, I could talk for hours about them and tell you all kinds of things and stories about clinical laboratories. But what I want to relate this to now is money. Money systems have been built up by humans to act like body systems in a way. Why? Because you've got inflation being controlled by interest rates. Say in the body, you might have enzymes that control body functions and in genes and various things, or maybe turn something on in the body or turn it off. Well, the interest rates inside the system of the monetary system, if they go higher, it shuts down the economy, which makes the economy slow down. And when the economy slows down, this means that you get a different reaction with the system of money. Okay. And what happens then is that inflation slows down, especially when we have a depression or a recession. Now, it's kind of depressing to know that the human body can get sick, but it's very, very depressing to know that your money can get sick and that it's our fault, humans, because we're the ones that built the monetary system. Now, God, if you believe, you know, what I believe, built the human body system. Did he use science to build it? Personally, I think he did. But some people could disagree with me on that. But once you learn about science, you can't help but believe these kind of things, that it's a tool that is used for building a body system and making a body system well or sick. But when it comes to money, there's all kinds of other systems. There's the system of, and I, for lack of being able to explain it any better, let's just say the security system, where stocks and bonds are sold, options are created and sold. That's another one. That's like a subunit of the stocks and bonds. You have the option system, whereas you can buy a theoretical guess of whether a stock is going to go up or down. Okay, so this is amazing that the humans have put this thing together and created a monetary system. Back in the olden days, we didn't have a monetary system. It was a barter system, which was a form of money. But the governments have should I say, bettered or worsed it by making a monetary system that runs off of all kinds of different manipulations. In the United States, the dollar is actually based upon the government backing it up now. I mean, you used to have a gold system, and then you had a silver system. Those have all been obliterated. Why? Because there's not enough gold in Fort Knox, not enough silver anywhere to back up the amount of dollars that they have printed. So this is a cancer inside the body of money. And whenever you get, getting back to the clinical laboratory in the body, once that too many cells are built up in the bone marrow, or too many cells are built up in the mass of cancer, it's going to potentially kill you, because it will overtake the system and kill you. It packs it out. Okay. So the same thing can be said about money. Once they print too much money and it packs out too much in the body of the monetary system inside the world or inside the United States or whatever you want to call it, it's out there. Everybody uses it. This monetary system can become so packed that it kills the system, and the system collapses and dies. Yes, we can recreate another monetary system, or we can start all over again. But what happens is the same thing that happened to the Southern states whenever the Confederate money collapsed. It was worthless. You couldn't use it. It went away. And this is a form of a disease, okay? Not necessarily the human body. Humans have created it, but essentially we are sick. Right now, we're sicker than we have ever been monetarily. And we have a cancer. It's called inflation. It's called genetically, if you would call it genetics inside, the people have gone crazy that are running this system, thinking that they can go on forever with a sick system, as sick as it is. And yes, I do believe that eventually we're going to have a collapse like we did in 1929. Now, would we have one in the next few weeks or few months? It depends on who you read, what the economist is that you're reading, okay? But when you get older, like me, I'm 69, or you're 55 plus, and you don't have 25 years or 10 years or 15 years or 5 years or whatever it takes to recover and for them to revive the system and get it going again. You lose your wealth because the system's sick, because the body of the monetary system is sick. The blood is not flowing properly. They pumped up too much in it. You know, when the body makes too much blood, a lot of times they have to bleed the body to get the blood out because too much blood will kill you, okay? And there's several diseases that will do that. You can study about that if you want to. But essentially, that's what's happening to the body of the monetary system. It has too many dollars and it's packing out, and there's a lot of dollars chasing fewer goods. And so when that gets so bad that you get sick, eventually the monetary system collapses. And that's what I'm afraid is about to happen. Maybe in the next 2, 3 to 10 years. There's all kinds of economists who say it's got to happen. It has to happen and recrank again, get rid of all the bad stuff. In other words, why do people die so that the new can take over? Okay. That's why babies are being born every day, because the older people just go away. So the monetary system will probably have to do the same thing. It'll have to go. Just think about the Roman money. It's gone forever. Just think about, you know, the Nazi German money. It's gone forever. Just think about the China before the communists took over, money and bonds. Those are gone forever. Just think about Iraqi money that a lot of people are buying right now. It's a novelty in my mind, but some people think it's going to be revitalized, but it's gone probably forever. It's probably never coming back. Why? Because the system that guaranteed it and structured it is dead and gone, okay? So we do not want the United States to be dead and gone. Maybe we have to get sick and then be revitalized, re-resurrected, okay? And that is called a depression or a major recession. And in 2008, we had a major recession, but we did not have a major depression. And will we ever have another major depression? It depends on how good on balancing by manipulation that the Federal Reserve is at keeping the money system going. But when you print too much of it and it's sick, they may not be able to, in other words, even though they're the money doctors trying to keep it going, just like the medical doctors keep the human body going, they probably are going to fail somewhere between now and 2030. And it could be around the corner because of what they've done. This debt is going to kill us. It's like a cancer in the human body will kill you. Too much debt is like a cancer in the monetary body, and it will kill our system, our economic system, and it will die, and then it'll have to be resurrected and start all over again. But wouldn't you like to have your money not be taken away from you by collapsing inside the stock market? Even if the system got sick and had to recrank again, as long as it's under the United States, they can't make that money go away, even though they may resurrect it as far as the economy goes. So to save this money and to keep you from losing your retirement plan with these crazy liberals, wouldn't it be better to put it somewhere that if the stock market keeps going up, you make money, but if it goes down, you don't lose your assets? Wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't it be better? That's what we do. That's what we do. You go to the doctor to get medicine to keep you going. You come to asset preservationist to get protection to keep your money safe. Similar thing. Very similar thing, but it works. We, as long as the United States holds together, the dollar will be there. So instead of losing that money in a collapse when the stock market gets wiped out, you still have the dollars in our system. And when it recranks, everything's great. You don't have to worry about having 5, 10, 15, 20 years for that money to come back because it never went away. But you still make a good return. Fantastic return. You say, David, none of this makes any sense. Well, take the time to give us a call. It doesn't cost a dime to call anymore because you have got that cell phone in your hand. And the numbers, I'm going to let Matthew give those numbers, and you can call me. We don't charge for people coming to talk to us. We never charge a fee. We're commission driven, and we can show you how we can give you satisfaction and peace of mind knowing that you won't lose a dime with these guaranteed products, guaranteed by these insurance companies that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, some of them. So think about this. Call us. We're here for you. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to talk to you. And I know this was a serious show about medicine and clinical laboratories and stuff. I wanted to talk about it because, you know, we have the health and wealth. And so I wanted to mix in the health along with the wealth. So have a great day. Matthew, take it away.
Thank you, David. Anyone out there that would like to get in touch with Earnest Financial, please dial 334-279-7431, or you can dial 205-479-0839. He's also on the web at retirewithearnest.com. And that's going to do it for tonight's show. Thanks for listening, and come back tomorrow for more of the Health and Wealth Show with David Earnest.
All matters discussed during this show are for informational purposes only. Each individual situation may vary, and the opinions expressed here may not apply to everyone. Materials presented are believed to be from reliable sources, and no representations can be made as to its accuracy. All ideas and information should be discussed in detail with one of our qualified representatives prior to implementation.